You pretty good with that shotgun?
Not that I have to be at this range, but I'm a fucking surgeon with this shotgun.
Well, guess what, bitch? I'm better than Annie Oakley, and I got you right in my sight.
I could blow your fucking head off.
Not before I put one right between your eyes. So let's talk. I just found out, not a moment before you blew a hole through the door, that I'm pregnant.
What is this?
On the floor by the door is a strip that says I'm pregnant.
Bullshit.
Any other time, you'd be 100% right. But this time, you're 100% wrong. I'm the deadliest woman in the world. But right now, I'm just scared shitless for my baby.
Welcome to part two of our Kill Bill Volume 2 episode. This keeps getting more and more ridiculous. I guess we should be glad that there's not a Volume 3. Before we go into real talk, it's time for PP, our patron pitch. This is where we let our patrons know what they can expect in their exclusive patron feed, and we let non-patrons know what they're missing out on, such as our cutting room floor segments. Those are available to every patron from the ground up, Travolta's tier all the way upwards. If you are a patron, you get to listen to the things that don't make it to the main feed. Did Chaz get too raunchy? It's cut, but it goes to the patron feed.
That rant he had about global politics was pretty upsetting.
Don't worry, if you're a patron, you get to listen to it. So that's one thing. The other thing is the bonus episodes. Every month, we get at least one bonus episode just for patrons. And that's going to be about the movie Om Shanti Om this month. It's an Indian movie. It's a long movie. It's a musical. It's a drama. It's everything you've come to expect from Indian cinema if you've listened to us covering it. And if you're a patron, you know we've done a few of these. So this is from patron Ryan from Spit and Polish and the Yum Yum podcast. Ryan, who's already on the chat, he hasn't even listened to the episode because it hasn't been posted yet, but he's already commenting on Alex's reaction to the runtime.
The fuck did he expect? He knows it too.
The chat, by the way, something else that you have access to if you are a patron. Just download the patron app, get in the chat. All tiers have access to it. Now, if you want more, then you move up a tier to the Winonis, the $3 tier. And then you have access to our pre-recording notes. You get access to our video reviews. This month, Alex, I did a little more digging on the movies that we were assigned. You got the good one. You know, you got a horror movie, which is up your alley. It's an hour and 39 minutes, and it's fresh on the tomato meter. Certified fresh. That's the movie What Keeps You Alive, assigned to you by Stu. And then Stu gave me a movie that doesn't even have a tomato meter score. It has, all it has is a Jerry O'Connell's Owned. Face on the poster. 57% audience score, though. It's the movie Deep Murder, an hour and 35 minutes from 2019. I don't know, man. Every now and then, I feel like the patrons, because you complain harder, the patrons go easy on you. And then they know I'll just take anything with a smile. So they give me the Jerry O'Connell movie.
Not all of them. Some of them like to challenge me. And I applaud and appreciate that. And I call it on.
That's true. That's true. Speaking of Ryan, sometimes you get a Bad Boy Bobby.
Which I still think about regularly.
Scarred for life. So you get access to that, the video reviews. And then you also get access to Contrarians After Hours. That's the spin-off show where we tell you about other things that we're watching, that we're reading, that we're listening to, that we're playing. Alex, what are you bringing to Contrarians After Hours this time?
It's a twofer. Usually After Hours or a Julio sandwich. He's the svelte in shape one of us, so it makes sense that he's like the thin covers on each side, and I'm just the fat middle, because that's usually what it constructs. But I actually, if you have multiple things, and we're going to be making a double-decker here of sorts, but
let's give you a stew.
Yeah, a meatloaf. Like a chili or something.
Yeah.
All right, so beginning with the 2005 film Shop Girl, with the screenplay by Steve Martin, starring Steve Martin, Claire Danes, the incomparable Claire Danes, and Jason Schwartzman. This is a movie that I have owned. I got it at a Goodwill or a thrift store or a flea market or something for probably 50 cents or a dollar. And I've had it in my collection for years and years and years. I remember the trailer for it in college because it had an Explosions in the Sky song used in the trailer. And I always wanted to watch it and just never got around to it until now. So we'll be talking about my thoughts on that. In addition, I'm going to be discussing, you know, Julio, I did one of my things where I just forced myself to watch something new. So I can at least, like, if I go to a party or something, have something to talk about. So I binged the show from last summer titled Based on a True Story, starring Kaylee Cuoco, the gal from
Big Bang Theory. It
was Big Bang Theory, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. And Chris Messina, who's like a pretty big that guy, but yep. I feel like a pretty solid actor. Anyway. So Shop Girl and Based on a True Story, we have some film and television to discuss here. One is only 20 years old and the other one is very recent. So we'll be talking about something new. So that's what I'm bringing. What are you bringing to the table?
Well, you said film, you said TV, and I'm combining that because I just want to talk about the Oscars, Alex. At the time of recording this Patron Pitch, the Oscars are about a week away. But by the time that we record the After Hours, the Oscar will be behind us. And, you know, we're big Oscar fans. I think every episode we try to talk about the Oscars that were going on whenever the movie that we're talking about took place. So, yep. Well, this will be very recent. This will be the Oscars as they're happening almost. I have seen, as of this recording, most of the Best Picture nominees. I'm missing three. And I'm pretty sure I can knock out those three before Sunday. And I've gotten most of the acting ones and most of the screenplay ones. I think basically I'm just, if I knock out these three movies, I am good, except for international features and, of course, you know, the shorts and some of the other ones. But all the big awards, I think I'll have them covered by Sunday. So that's exciting because last couple of years I didn't get to do that. You, Alex, I think this hasn't happened in at least, what, 5 years that you've seen more than one nominee? Now you've seen Oppenheimer, Barbie, Killers of the Flower Moon, May, December, The Holdovers. That's five already. My God.
So, I'm thriving this year, man.
Yeah. So I think that we're actually going to have the potential for a good conversation about the Oscars is there. So that's going to be the After Hours. And then if you want to be part of those patrons that tell us what to watch, well, that's what the $5 tier, the Embrys, and the $10 tier, the Gads, that's what those are for. So go to patreon.com/contrarianprime, look at the tiers, look at what we're offering, and see how you would like to join the Contrarian Supplements.
$1, $3, $5, and $10 are the respective tiers that my co-host Julio just laid out. Four quarters will get you access on the ground floor just to take a look around, see what's there. If you want to bump up, you can. If you want to keep it there, you can. You'll have access to the chat. You'll have access to, you know, our Roxana journey, our Lindsay Lohan career retrospective, and everything in between to all of our current patrons. We love y'all dearly. We have our goals out there, our patron goals of when we cross the threshold of 30, 40, and 50 patrons, the projects that we'll tackle respectively with those. So if you're a fence sitter, that's how I typically live my life. I understand. But in this particular case, I'd encourage you to kind of just, you know, lift the other leg over and step into the lawn of the Contrarian's patron. So that's it. That's our patron pitch. Now, I think, are we finally going to be done with this fucking Kill Bill movie?
Well, I left Chaz buried underground as we were closing into his corner, and I can hear him almost breaking through the coffin. So he might be ready for real talk. Let's do that.
May I have a glass of water, please?
Chaz, are you back with us?
I'm shaking off the dirt and pretending like I'm in a horror movie.
All right. Well, we are back for real talk. Episode 200, Kill Bill Volume 2. Not particularly a good movie.
Oh, man.
I love Quentin Tarantino. That is no breaking news here. I've spoken favorably, famously, when we did Pulp Fiction. I had a very difficult time doing that episode because trying to make that movie sound bad is quite the undertaking to me. So, as I mentioned, had not seen this before, thought I had. It's now checked off the list. It is not for me. And we'll get a little bit further into that here momentarily. But before that, 84% of Rotten Tomatoes. So it means there's a decent chunk of folks there that submitted their reviews and said, hey, here's this nasty, slimy green splotch because this ain't for me either. A step down by 1% from Kill Bill Volume 1, as we mentioned. Julio, what was the beef with Volume 2? What didn't people like about it?
Green splotches, Alex. It could just be the swap. You swap Lucy Liu for David Carradine, and that's when you start getting the green splotches. We're going to start with Christopher Orr from The New Republic, who says, where Kill Bill 1 had the pace of an ADHD six-year-old and a sugar high, Kill Bill 2 has been ritalinized. Its tempo is slowed down to a crawl in self-conscious and self-defeating imitation of Sergio Leone. It's 2 hours that feel like five. That just sounds like Alex Mattis talking.
Yeah, man. I was just pumping my fist the whole time.
Next, Will Self from London Evening Standard. I don't even want to do Tarantino and his pathetic accomplices the honor of recounting the narrative of the second volume of this exercise in trash peddling. And frankly, I don't need to because there isn't a plot to speak of. Okay, come on now. There is a plot. You could argue there's more plot than in volume one, right?
A lot of the plot of this movie is just saying, hey, remember this part from part one?
I mean, I feel like there is actually less plot because it really is just Bud and Bill, essentially, right? Whereas in the first one, you've got the bride like piecing together what happened and, you know, recovering from the coma and like getting out and retraining and the Hanzo Hattori sword. And I feel like there's a lot more that actually happens in the first movie than happens in this movie.
But you got Pai Mei, you got Esteban.
You do. You're not helping your case here, man.
I'm not saying it's good plot. I'm just saying it's plot. All right, next, David Walsh from World Socialist website. Kill Bill is not a critique of sadistic bullying. It revels in it. The film itself is oppressive and bullying, as well unpleasantly pleased with itself. I don't know. You know, I was much younger when I watched this the first time, and so maybe I'm more sensitive to like some of the stuff here. I think that Bud is a particularly nasty character, but then so was, what's his fucking name? David
Buck.
Michael, yeah, Buck in the first one. I think Buck remains like the biggest piece of shit in all of Tarantino's filmography. But I mean, if you're going to call this one a bullying movie, a movie that revels in bullying, I guess maybe, because as Chaz was saying in Contreras Corner, I don't know how much of it you meant, but you know, the bride is a lot more of a punching bag in this movie. And so I can see how that would turn some people off. But did you guys have that problem? Did you feel that it went too far in that direction?
I don't think, like every Tarantino movie, there's going to be criticism of the violence and how it's portrayed. And I think he is enjoying himself. And I, you know, what I like about Tarantino's use of violence is it is to be enjoyed, but also he doesn't kind of shy away from the consequences of it. Like there are, I think, all the PG superhero movies, they want you to enjoy the action, but then don't show any kind of consequence to, you know, thousands of people being mown down or, you know, buildings being destroyed or what have you. So, yeah, I felt like this film, I think we all felt that this film treated the violence differently from the first one. And maybe that's what he's getting at. But I instinctively don't want to agree with anyone who's criticizing violence in Tarantino films because it's like, well, don't watch Tarantino films.
Yes. Because my first instinct was to say, well, if you feel that way about Volume 2, you probably felt that way about Volume 1. And so why were you even watching Volume 2? But you're right that Volume 1 gives you a little bit of an out because it's, well, for one, she is doing most of the, inflicting most of the violence, but also it's a little more cartoony. And this one, as cartoony as Pai Mei is, I mean, I think that this one tries to root itself a little more in reality. All right, we're going to close with Keith H. Brown from Eye for Film, who says, if Kill Bill is a comeback film, Tarantino's future career prospects look about as good as Mike Tyson's. The Emperor's New Clothes are showing.
That was rude. Mike was having some troubles in those days. Mike's had a lot of troubles, and he's got more troubles now because apparently he's fighting again. So,
okay, but he's calling Kill Bill a comeback film, which means that he thinks Jackie Brown was something that Tarantino needed to come back from.
Well, it could also mean comeback in the sense of he just hadn't made a movie in X amount of years.
Mm. Oh, okay, okay. Maybe. Okay, we'll give Keith H. Brown the benefit of the doubt. All right, but those are the quotes. I'm really curious how this went. I really want the cliffhanger resolved as far as like Chaz's Letterboxd review. And I want to know, Alex, I mean, we can tell that you didn't like it. I'm curious if you...
Do you have other episodes where Contrarian's Corner is basically real talk preview?
Sometimes it feels like it.
Well, I don't know how much y'all were acting. I did not like this. This is not even more so than volume one. Not for me.
That was going to be my question, Alex, because I thought that maybe there was a chance that because this is different from Kill Bill 1 in certain ways, that maybe those differences would engage you in a way that Kill Bill 1 didn't. But I also knew that there was a big chance that those differences would actually repel you even further away, which might have been the case. Yeah, let's start there, Alex, because you're the newbie here. You're watching this for the first time.
Mm. Yes. It honestly, to me, and again, this is, we talked about, there's a very loud contingent of supporters for this movie. I would just call it a swing and a miss. And everyone's done it. You and I are both, Julio, that is, are both very critical of Wolf of Wall Street. But we both still think Martin Scorsese is one of the greatest filmmakers that's ever lived. And, you know, Tarantino is someone, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Pulp Fiction, Jackie Brown, Django and Inglourious Bastards to a lesser degree, Reservoir Dogs, you know, that he's made these movies that are just synonymous with film in my lifetime. And he's someone that until he stops making movies, which I guess his next one's going to be his last one, I will go see it and I will enjoy it. This just strikes me as something that was too ambitious. Maybe it's very rare you'll catch me saying something like this. Maybe if he just made that 4-hour cut that he wanted, there'd be a better flow to it, because it's Tarantino through and through on both sides. But the first one comes with wild action that you come to expect with Tarantino. And with the exception of one scene in this, there's really not any of that. But what this movie does have is that Tarantino dialogue. But the problem is here, it's just the pacing. It's paced. They're paced differently. They both are paced poorly, in my opinion. But one is so much more, like, it's such a front-heavy 1-2 punch that the ending of this is just, to me, so anticlimactic in just the sense of how it all plays out. You know, he kind of learned that, too. You look at something like Django or Inglourious Bastards, like and especially Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the bloodletting comes in the last moments of the movie. And, you know, here, I feel like if he made this again today, you would see like David Carradine's, like his body would just like explode or some shit. He would do something insane like that. It's weird because this one feels like there's more backstory than the first one. And the second movie is supposed to be the thing that like ties everything up and kind of makes all the questions from the first one make sense. And I ended up with this just with more questions than I had after the first one. And it's possibly more than any of his movies, the one that screams passion project. And, you know, there's respect I give him for that. Cause you know, he was like Django and Glorious and, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was so vocal about like wanting to make those movies and whatnot, but they're just still made in a sense of like, man, this is just a really good movie. Whereas this just yells to me that this is something the director specifically wanted to do. And it was at a point in time also where, of course, Miramax was going to capitalize on it. It was the comeback, as that guy said, not that he had been down, but it was like he hadn't made a movie since Jackie Brown. So let's see what's going on. And now he's bulletproof. You know, it seems like this was the perfect timing for him to make this movie. It's just in the long game of it all, this is bottom of the barrel for me.
If you're going to compare a Hanzo sword You compare it to every other sword ever made. Wasn't made by a Tori Hanzo.
Wow.
I don't mean that bottom of the barrel of like films in general.
Just
I mean
the Tarantino that, like, curve.
Tarantino ranking. This would be the last. I would put them as a pair and they would be at the bottom.
Wow. Under Death Proof?
Okay, so that's a whole different thing. That's something that I typically don't include in my Tarantino rankings because
doesn't even count.
In a gimmicky filmmaker world, that was like its own gimmicky whole experiment, the Grindhouse. Because to me, you have to like include both. We're not here to discuss that, but it needs to be stressed.
But you prefer Hateful Eight over this.
Hateful Eight's the one I haven't seen.
Well.
So I have been told by numerous people, they're like, you would hate that movie. So I've just never kind of gotten around to seeing it. I need to at this point so I can fairly malign the Kill Bills. But something I need to stress here, though, is that I don't think this is a bad movie. I find it boring and it's not for me. But like going back to Wolf of Wall Street, like I think that's a bad movie. I don't like that movie. I think it's just poorly structured, executed, etc., etc. The point I'm trying to make here is this is like not a good Tarantino movie to me, but that doesn't mean that I think it's like bad. Like, you know, spoiler alert, I'd probably end up giving this like a C minus or some shit. It's just that I have to be, this may seem a bit vicious because I'm also talking about the same guy who made Pulp Fiction, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and these movies that I think are like top tier shit. So fairly boring, but the acting is there. Michael Madsen is awesome. And I have this pulled up in front of me as I had to look up immediately if putting rock salt in a shotgun is a real thing. And from the mouth of babes, guns.com, are rock salt shotgun shells useful for self-defense? And I guess this entry had something to do with Kill Bill because it said rock salt shotgun shells are something of an urban myth in the world of guns. People have often claimed that it's an effective non-lethal round, but it's hard to tell if there's any truth behind that. One of the problems is that Hollywood got its hands on it, so you end up with wacky scenes like this one. And it's the bride getting shot. And basically the breakdown of it is if you get shot 60 feet away, it'll sting but not break the skin. 30 feet, probably going to break the skin. 12 feet, first aid territory is what it says. And then if you're shot at the range that Uma Thurman was shot in this movie. Yeah, it says you need to phone an ambulance at best or take a trip to the morgue at worst. So I was just genuinely curious about that because I'm like, that still would kill her. It's shrapnel getting shot at you out of a fucking gun. But anyway, you know, to be fair, Beatrix is tougher than most of us. So
yes,
there still is like sword fighting and shit in this. So there's fun to it. I don't want to make it sound like, you know, fucking Drop Dead Fred or I'm
still bitter at both of you for that.
Oh no. Another one bites Hancock. The dust.
Hancock is always the worst. Hancock is bottom of the barrel every single time this comes up. And this is such a better movie than Hancock. The only reason I'm sounding so negative about it is, like I said, it comes from a vaunted filmmaker. And yeah, but there's a Black Mamba biting Michael Madsen in the face. They're sword fighting in this. So there is fun shit to it. It's just like, brother, can we hurry this up? Julio, I'm curious. Actually, let's do a contrarian sandwich here. Chaz, your thoughts upon revisiting it, not only that, but revisiting it in close proximity to the first one. What stuck out, good and bad? Did you walk away from it? Greater appreciation, more on the fence? Where are you coming out now?
So my theatrical experience was much preferred volume 2 to volume 1. Revisiting it now after, you know, we've got Inglourious Basterds and Django Unchained and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I now prefer volume 1 to volume 2. And I gave it 3.5 stars on Letterboxd. I still think the main thing that I disliked about it on this viewing was just how they made her stupid. Like her, Bud getting the drop on her and Bill shooting her with the tranquilizer dart and her not getting to kill Bud just undermined everything that I felt like he had achieved with volume one. What did I enjoy? I did actually, like, I did revel in his indulgent dialogue. Like, I really enjoyed actually the Bill and Bride opening chat, knowing what's about to happen, like the sort of charm and love and stuff that's there, but the underlying sense of dread. I really liked Michael Parks as Brazilian random pimp, like just chewing the scenery. Like, I enjoyed sitting there, much as I enjoyed the Hanzo Hattori scene and, you know, when he was sushiing in the first one. So, like, there's definitely some good stuff here. I said it in Contrarian's Corner, where I still don't think there's substance here. Like, there's a lot more talking, but I don't think the talking builds to anything anywhere near as meaningful as the aforementioned Inglourious Bastards. And I keep referring to those three films, Bastards, Django, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, because I think it is just as indulgent as this. It can be just as violent. It can be just as meandering, or, you know, told out of order or what have you. But they just feel like epic, incredible cinematic experiences that you won't get from any other filmmaker. And this is not that.
It's they are captivating in a way that this wasn't. And I was bummed because, like I said in Contrarian's Corner, I haven't watched this since it came out. Like, that realization, much like Alex realizing that he had never seen it, my realization was like, I've never watched this again. And I remember coming out of the theater disappointed because, and I think that it's actually a very logical reaction. I think that Kill Bill 1 does not prepare you for the kind of movie Kill Bill 2 is going to be. And if you didn't like Kill Bill 1, like was the case with you, Chaz, it makes sense that Kill Bill 2, at least on a first-time watch, would feel like, oh, well, now he got it, you know? And for me, it was like, what happened to all the cool stuff that I enjoyed in Kill Bill 1? Like, it's gone, you know? And it wasn't so much the idea that the bride is just on the losing end a lot in this movie, although that's probably, you know, at least subconsciously, that has to be part of it. But just that there was an epic sense of fun in Kill Bill 1 that I remember missing from Kill Bill 2. It's like, I want to see her kick Bud's ass. You know, I want to see a big, massive fight with Bill, because she got to do that with Lucy Liu. So why wouldn't she do it with Carradine, you know? So on that level, I remember being let down. But then my thought going into a rewatch all these years later was like, all right, well, I know that that's not going to happen. So can I appreciate Kill Bill 2 for the movie the Kill Bill 2 is, you know, since I know that it's not the movie I wanted it to be? And the answer was that sadly, not so much. Like, I think that the things that I liked when I watched in theaters, I still liked. And the things that I didn't like dragged so much more. I felt like you, Alex. Whenever I get like very, very, whenever I can feel the length of a movie, I'm like, oh, this is... If I'm feeling it, Alex must be just in absolute hell. And the Michael Park scene, man, it's, I remember not liking it in theaters, and I didn't like it here, because it just, it stops the movie for no reason. It's just like, in the way that
he talks like fucking Davy Jones from Pirates of the Caribbean.
Just dragging it all out and meaningless conversation. But you're right that the movies that we prefer of his, you could accuse them of doing that, right? So what makes a difference? What makes a good Tarantino monologue versus something that just feels like fluff, right? Because, okay, so let's say that there's not that much substance here, but he's trying, right? That I think
a
that he's...
A big part of this, though, is like, it feels like a sizzle reel. It feels like isolated clips from different types of movies. Whereas, you know, obviously, something like Pulp Fiction, you can immediately say, well, yeah, that's just a bunch of jumbled up scenes, but they all like flow with each other. Like, I mean, from the literal sense of like cinematography and presentation, yeah, and like, you know, which Instagram filter he put on which part of which scene, it feels disjointed to the point where you do get to those like classic Tarantino dialogue based scenes. And it's like, the fuck? She was just, you know, there was a guy who had a comically long beard making her punch a board 2 seconds ago. Like, it feels like puzzle pieces that don't fit together for me.
I'm a killer. I'm a murdering bastard. You know that? And there are consequences to breaking the heart of a murdering bastard.
Well, but then that leads to really the biggest question mark, and I mentioned it in Contrarian's Corner. It's like, how does a 4-hour cut of this movie work? Because
It's a good question.
It feels they feel disjointed even as separate movies. And I think if you put them together, that's even more noticeable. Like, what would you have to do? You have to reshoot some stuff, I think. You have to, you know, make it all feel like Volume 1, make it all feel like Volume 2. How does Pai Mei fit in it, you know?
You'd have to do, like, the whole first hour would be, like, that Kung Fu style shit he wants to do, like, of the backstory of with Pai Mei and whatnot. I would think. But even that 4-hour cut, you know, it still peaks with the crazy 88s, you know, the whatever the bloodshed sequence, the name of it, whatever they called it, with Uma Thurman just wrecking shop with the katana and whatnot. It's that's any movie you make, that's still the peak of it, because that part is so fucking cool. I think I was just because I was contrarian brained in that first one. I don't know if I gave that the credit it deserves, but that sequence fucking rules, man. That's one of, you know, from just a pure visual perspective, that's something, one of the bigger ones for Quentin to hang his hat on.
I think I think Volume 2 might have Elizabeth Town Volume 1 in your brain.
Well, I don't know about that, because I don't think I'm ever going to rewatch either of these movies. But
I mean, to be fair, I enjoyed rewatching them. I had a good time. I think these is by no means Tarantino's worst films. And I will happily rewatch them again in the future, but they're just so much more disposable than...
It's a good word.
Almost everything else he's made.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about David Carradine, because this was, you know, his movie. He sat out Volume 1, and this was the big thing, right? I think that a lot of people felt that this was going to be something that was going to bring him back, right? Like, that was what Tarantino was doing, you know, Travolta, Pam Grier. And so I guess it did, in a sense, because he was part of the conversation. Suddenly everybody was talking about him. But I don't recall it leading to more, leading roles, or even him getting any prominence in big movies. Honestly, the next thing I remember seeing him in was one of the Scary Movies, I think. He has like a bit role in one of those parody movies, and it was just heartbreaking, because I was like, you were Bill not too long ago. And I don't know how you explain it. Like, Robert Forster came out of like Jackie Brown, and he was, you know, it's not like he was headlining blockbusters, but from then on you just kind of like saw Robert Forster everywhere, right? Like, oh, they cast him in this supporting role, and that didn't happen with David Carradine. And I don't think it's a performance, or at least not only the performance. I think that there's just something about Tarantino finding the character of Bill and the performance of Carradine as Bill a lot more engaging, more compelling than I do. And I think that maybe if it happened to me, it happened to a lot of people. They're like, you know what? We get it with Travolta and Vincent Vega. We get it with Pam Grier and Jackie Brown, Robert Forster, Max Cherry, definitely Sam Jackson and anything he's played in the movie. But when it comes to Carradine and Kill Bill, well, it's okay just for this movie. But I don't see a way that it translates beyond that. But I don't know. How do you guys feel about him as an actor? I don't have that much of an experience, you know, outside of Kill Bill and like a couple of cameos. Fucking Camille. He's in Camille, and I know that. But I never watched Kung Fu, so I missed that big chunk of his work.
He was kind of an interesting guy. And then I think the way he passed also kind of built to his legacy of intrigue. As far as like, I have a pretty limited experience with his filmography as well. Chaz, you pull us out of this hole here. You familiar with?
I'll reiterate what I said in Contrarian's Corner, where I genuinely think that he did Charm and Menace. I just think the, you know, Superman speech and the truth serum just undid a lot of good work throughout the film. And I guess that lack of climax that you guys felt at the end.
I have no idea what this means, but I love it so much. In the original script, the fight between Beatrix Kiddo and L. Driver was supposed to resemble her fight with Oren Ishii. Quentin Tarantino revealed in an interview with Entertainment Weekly that he changed it the day after catching a showing of Jackass the Movie at the Alamo Drafthouse. I'm trying to think of anything that happens in Jackass that would resemble anything close to what happens here. I don't know.
They find that trailer?
Such a Tarantino thing to say. I love it. And with that, I found out that Daryl Hannah improvised her thing of just screaming and like crashing into shit on the set. She said she did it because she thought it would make Tarantino laugh, and he did, and he kept it in the final film, and that she sustained several injuries from breaking so many things on the set. Dedication, baby.
Yeah. I'm glad she had a good time.
I mean, I loved her in this movie. Like, to me, the highlight of the movie is the fight in the caravan.
I think it's a high point. Okay, so let me stop being so negative, because I do like this. And not just because Death Proof and Hateful Eight are under it, but also, much like you, Chaz, like, I had a good time watching it. I was just suddenly very aware that there were things that were not working, and kind of like that disappointment of, oh, I thought that maybe they were going to work this time and they didn't. But the sequence with Bud, I think it's really well constructed, even though I do find myself wondering, it's like, how much did we need to see of his life, you know, for it to work? Like, there's a big stretch of him going to his strip club and getting just basically emasculated by his boss and then by the workers there. So I think that there's a more economical way of telling that story and setting up that character. But I don't know if that's what I want, because I do enjoy the performance from Madsen, and I like the story beats and the idea that it's so different from everything we've seen from the villains, right? Like, Vivica Fox had a family, so she was kind of like settled, and Lucy Liu was like a gangster, basically, head mobster. And now here's this guy that's so down on his luck. And so, like, that's interesting. And Madsen can play the character really well. And so that whole sequence I really like. I can turn my brain off and go with the flow and assume and be okay with him getting the drop on the bride. I'm like, that's what the story needs me to, you know, because it takes us to Pai Mei, and I like Pai Mei or Pei Mei. And I do like L. And that fight is awesome. I like that they have that. I'm not a kung fu movie aficionado, but even I know that I Kill Your Sensei is like one of those tropes. So the fact that Tarantino found a way to make it work there, that's, you know, that was cool. It's a good chuckle. So really, you know, that first, I don't know, hour of the movie or so, like, I think it works.
So where do the wheels come off for you, Julio?
I think that once she gets rid of Bud and L, like, once Bud and L are out of the picture, we know that it's just Bill. And I think it is a problem that there's still an hour of movie left. Like, you know, take Esteban out. I don't know. I mean, maybe that's, you know, this is the problem when you have so much, like, flash and no substance in the previous 2 hours of movie, right? That when you have to, now you struggle to imbue that climax with meaning, when really all your audience wants is just, no, give me the thrill of, you know, the big fight or whatever. Because I know that the heart of the story is her reunion with her daughter and her resolving her undersold feelings with her ex-lover. But I am not connecting to anything that these two are saying. And maybe, Chad, the problem is that I don't find him charming. And,
okay,
you know, like, I kind of said in the Gutierrez Corner, if you're not buying into that relationship, then it's a lot harder to really mm-hmm. be invested in, like, oh, well, she loves him, but she hates him. And, mm-hmm. you know, that thing. I'm like, kill him.
Do you like it?
Yeah, I like it a lot, smartass.
Alex, did Carradine charm you?
I think he's excellent in the role. It's just, I think the story, there wasn't much for me to connect to, so I don't know if I warmed up to him in any way. Like, I harped on this in Contrarian's Corner. I really wanted to like that goldfish speech. Like, it seemed like something I should be connecting with. And I thought his delivery of it was good. But at that point in the movie, it was just like, I'm done. Let's move this along. Hell yeah. He's got a hell of a voice, man. And like that growl he has just in the opening when we see him for the first time. And you know, he surprises Uma Thurman. She talks about working in the record store and shit. I think that's really good. But yeah, I wouldn't. Charm would be a bit of an intense word to use.
You know, when I like him, this is my favorite moment of his. And that is in that sequence when the groom, who looks so much like Seth Rogen, by the way, but he comes out and meets him.
Yeah, I didn't know if I was supposed to know who that was.
I didn't recognize his name from anything. So I think he just was lucky enough to get cast as Uma Thurman's almost husband. But when he meets him and Uma Thurman introduces Carradine as her father, and his reaction to that, and then the way that he has to put on a show for this guy, and, you know, flashes the big smile and starts, you know, just pretending. And I'm like, that's cool. Like, that's because I like that. That shows
me. Especially when we know what Bill has planned. Exactly. Like, why is he doing it like that? Yeah.
So, all right. Question for you guys. Do you think that when he is there with her and they're having this conversation, he's already dead set on murdering everybody? Or is this him still trying to decide? You know, and there was a way that that conversation could have gone where he was like, all right, I'm not going to do it.
I mean, he doesn't have them summoning, you know, we're outside the church. We don't hear him say, come on in, vipers, you know. So, and they're obviously all there. I feel like it's been planned, but I guess he was open to walking out of the church and waving them away and doesn't, maybe. I don't know.
But then what is it that, when is it that he makes a decision? Like, that stuff I find, like, very interesting, but the movie doesn't really give it to me. And maybe, I mean, that's fair, you know? The movie doesn't have to give me anything. Maybe the movie just has to make me wonder. And then the reward should be that after the movie's over, I get to think, okay, but how much did he care? How much was he willing to kill her? How heartbroken was he? How clouded by anger was he? Alex, did you get a read one way or the other? Do you think that the bride and her soon-to-be extended family were, like, toast no matter what?
I would hope so, because then the movie would have been 10 minutes long. Like, there wouldn't have been any follow-up for it. I do think that's interesting. In the first one, it portrays it as, like, this ruthless just bloodletting, this, you know, execution of the bride and, you know, everyone around her. And in this one, it does at least present that quandary of, like, did he go there planning on doing that, or was he just so hurt that he kind of snapped? I don't think we're supposed to, I assume we're not supposed to feel one way or the other, but it at least adds an interesting wrinkle to that that idea.
I mean, and I also like that he, like, at the end, it does just boil down to the point where he admits, like, I'm just a terrible person.
I mean, that's true.
It's true.
Is that why it's so meaningful that he tells her that she's not a bad person, I guess? Or rather, that's meaningful that she calls herself a bad person and he corrects her? Is that, does that work for you?
Yeah. Look, to me, the one of the things I did like about it is that end sequence, as long as it was, is it felt like Bill was preparing to hand over the daughter to Beatrix. Like, he was introducing them so that the daughter would feel safe should he not survive the night. But I also buy that he wasn't, like, going to just give up, that he didn't know which way it was going to go. And if there was more of that in there, mm-hmm. if that was more overt and there was less truth serum bullshit, then maybe I would have, that climax would have really worked for me. Like, her crying on the floor at the end, it was a super powerful moment and performance, but it just didn't feel earned, weirdly, given everything that she has gone through, like the huge amounts of trauma that character has gone through, because it felt like she was mourning Bill when that didn't feel...
Yeah, I think that that's... you know, we joked about it a little bit last episode, because you have that closing voiceover from Hanzo, where he's talking about revenge and the path to revenge is so topsy-turvy that you can lose yourself and all that. And I don't think that this movie capitalizes on that idea. It's like, all right, the first movie wasn't going to do it, but let's see her lose herself in revenge so much that when she gets to the end, she's very confused. And then maybe that final scene is like this catharsis where, you know, she's just crying because, well, no matter what, it's over. But it doesn't, yeah, you're right. I mean, it doesn't build to that because most of the movie is just, you know, adventures and kung fu and fights and all that stuff. But I do think that that's an interesting setup. And I wish that there was, like we've been saying, I mean, I wish that there was more of that, because the idea of a woman that thinks of herself as a bad person, maybe justifiably so, because of what she's done with her life, and then deep down believes that even when she tried to turn a new leaf, she was not worthy of it. And if you can see how that reflects on the people, her associates, right? Why is Bud working at that bar? How did Vivica Fox manage to like actually have a kid and, you know, have a life? And why is Daryl Hannah so fucking angry all the time? There should be the idea that, okay, well, this is what happens when you're an assassin for hire and you lead this life. And man, I mean, it's a very, very neat trick if you pull it off, I guess, that you give us volume one where you hook us with all the fun stuff. And then the second volume is just all this introspective stuff, you know, that would have been amazing. But that's not what he does. It's kind of like he rushes to do it in the last 20 minutes of the movie and it just doesn't work. I appreciate all this theorizing a lot more than I appreciate the movie.
And maybe this thought means that there is more substance there than we give it credit for. It's just hinted at and not delved into as much as he does in his other films.
But is that us failing to recognize an asset of the movie, that it's just being so low-key about what it's about? Or is it a failing of the movie that it didn't really raise, you know, those elements to where they're more easily perceivable?
I don't think they're mutually exclusive.
Julio did reference it earlier, and worth calling out. The climax of the film was originally written to be a sword fight on a moonlit beach between Beatrix, clad in her wedding dress, and Bill. Production ran long, and Harvey Weinstein, redacted, insisted that Tarantino cut the scene back. All that remains is Bill's brief reference to such a fight with Beatrix while she sits on her sofa, and the film's poster showing Beatrix in the dress holding her sword. And yeah, the poster for this is just that. It's her brandishing the sword in her wedding dress. And it says, "The bride is back for the final cut." It's actually a pretty cool poster, not going
to
lie.
I used to have it. I took it from the theater, you know, from the outside. So it was pretty faded.
The sun-stained ones?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I was like, it looks cool.
Yeah, I assume that poster we're referencing of the bride returns for the final cut, that was the teaser poster, because the other two, you know, for better or for worse, are pretty iconic. The yellow and black and red and yellow.
Mm. Well, quick question, Alex. Because yes. I agree with you that the action-wise, the peak is the fight with the crazy 88. So what about this cut where the climax of the movie is this massive fight between Bill and the bride, moonlight, beach, just he goes all out. Would you guys find that more sad? Because I want to say I would. I think that that's something that, you know, it would harken back to what I felt in Kill Bill 1. I would get that adrenaline rush to close the movie, which I don't really get from the final confrontation here.
Yeah, that's what it's missing.
I'm actually happy with their fight being the 20-second fight over the deck chairs. The shitty thing was the preceding 25 minutes. Like, I don't think anything was going to top the Crazy 88 fight as a one-on-one fight. I liked the knife fight.
What if it did, Chaz? Have faith in Tarantino.
You and I have unfinished business.
Baby, you ain't kidding.
I think it could have at least ended the movie on a high note, but you know, I say it's Tarantino making the movie he wants to make, and that's obviously not true because
because the Weinsteins.
Yeah, I mean, and that's, I said that about Rob Zombie too, and that's obviously a joke because he had similar experiences with them in terms of not to compare the artistic contributions to society of Quentin Tarantino and Rob Zombie, but I mean, I think anyone who's ever made a film will tell you you have to pick your battles and you're going to have to make cuts regardless. But I think for the most part, I stand by my statement of this is Tarantino. Like, you watch this and you can see through the screen. It's the one he had like the most like emotional investment in making the way he wanted it to be made. And I think that's good for him. Didn't work for me the way some of his others have. But again, I guess the closing point I have is that doesn't mean it's a bad movie. It's just not for me the way his others are.
But I think it taught him how to vary tone without varying style.
Dude, it is, and we haven't talked about this, it is a fascinating thing to call out how early in his career this came, like this project. Yeah. And like everyone just thinks of Tarantino always being Tarantino because that's what the image he's crafted for himself. But again, this was technically just his fourth movie, because, you know, he made these both around the same time and stringed them together. And to have such a public, you know, rookie run, so to speak, you know, your decade long rookie year just in the public eye. And it's you're exactly right. I think he took things away from this that undoubtedly fine tuned or polished aspects of your Django's or your Inglourious Bastards that, you know, may have gone unpolished in, you know, other circumstances. You know what I mean?
Well, I know this is just speculation, but I do wonder, because this was still a success, right? So this is followed by Death Proof, which that's his one flop. So did he need...
I mean, he's collectively made over $300 million. Right. So, yeah.
So did he need the experience of doing the Kill Bills, but also the financial failure of Death Proof, so he could really just kind of be shaking out of it and be like, all right, well, maybe I do need to stop doing just what I want and think of the audience a little bit.
You know, like, I think of Inglourious Basterds, which was like coming back out of that and, you know, winning. He won an Oscar for that, didn't he? Or at least was nominated. And Brad Pitt's and Michael Fassbender's characters are like they're in two different movies, and yet they share a scene together and they work. Right? And it's not like this, where Pai Mei and Bud could not share a scene together.
Yep.
You could not put those two characters, the way they're portrayed in this film, in the same scene together.
That's such a good point, man. Because it's really at the crux of my... It's not even like what makes a movie bad or what makes a movie good. It's just what makes a movie kind of confusing to me. Like, when, you know... The big question, maybe the most interesting thing about the Kill Bills is just that I don't understand how they fit together. And how he thought that they would fit together. But it works in other movies. You're right. I mean, I thought you were going to say that Brad Pitt and Fassbender were both cartoonish. I was like, what are you talking about? Fassbender is, you know, one of the most grounded characters there.
Yeah.
All right, so you guys already gave your scores, so there's no suspense there. I think that what we should
No.
I think that it was kind of, like you said, sometimes Contreras Corner ends up being a lot, but I don't know how it feels to the listeners. As we were recording, I was like, yeah, this is a lot of, I am expressing my feelings. For me, it's a 3.5, too. I think that I sounded more negative than that score, but in the end, there's a lot of stuff I like. It's just that it kind of goes off the rails that last hour. But I think that the way to close, in fact, should be to establish the polls, as we should give our top three Tarantino movies. So, Alex, you go first.
And yeah, Julio, the closing point on that is, you know, this wasn't an F for me. It's 3.5 for y'all. Like, we're speaking critically, because again, we're talking about someone who made Pulp Fiction. So it's like, it's going to come across probably a bit more terse than intended. So for my top three Tarantinos, it would go from 3, 2, 1, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Oh, this is where I always get hung up. shit. It depends on which day you catch me on. It's either Pulp Fiction or Jackie Brown. And it does vary from time to time. I think with recency bias, I'll say Pulp Fiction 2 and Jackie Brown number 1. I do love that movie.
Wow.
You're gonna hunt me down, Alex.
Jackie Brown, not one of your favorites?
I mean, not in my top three.
It's better than Kill Bill.
Fine.
I've been wanting to rewatch Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I've only seen it one time in theaters. And so I could imagine it going up to number 2 on rewatch.
Wow.
But currently it's number 3 with Inglourious Basterds number 2 and Pulp Fiction number 1.
Excellent.
Mine is very similar, Chaz. I'm going to start with number 1. Number 1 is Pulp Fiction. I said it back when we did the Pulp Fiction episode. I've said it, I think, every time that Tarantino has come up. And number 2 is Inglourious Basterds. I've seen that movie a number of times. I'm looking at my old Tarantino ranked list on Letterboxd, and I had to laugh because at the time, obviously, I don't know how long ago I did this, but at the time, I had Kill Bill Volume 1 as number 3, which...
My God.
I had it over Jackie Brown at number 4, and that is insane. So I think that they, at the very least, need to swap places. Jackie Brown is number 3.
Is Kill Bill Volume 1 still number 4?
No, I think that The problem with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is I've seen it more than once, but it still feels like recency bias. Mm. You know, I'm like, it needs to marinate a few more years, but that would be my number four, really. And Kill Bill.
And you were on a horsey. Come on, man. You gotta have that up there.
I know, but I mean, just...
If nothing else from this podcast, I'm taking that I need to go and rewatch Jackie Brown.
You should, yeah.
It's quite fantastic. All right. So there it is. The moral of these two episodes together is that Pulp Fiction is a good movie.
And to go and watch Jackie Brown.
Watch Jackie Brown. And that Kill Bill is like right there in that middle era of Tarantino where he just started when he was Tarantinoing himself. And then thankfully he came out of that and they made the other movies that we appreciate a lot more. Mm-hmm. I'll be curious to hear from defenders, Kill Bill stans, those of you who are, you know, we've referenced you a few times here.
Shouted you out.
Yeah. Just let us know what we got wrong. Tell us what the movies are about. We've theorized a lot about it here, but I don't know that we have any concrete answers. And maybe that's the way it's supposed to be. But I don't think QT would be too happy with some of the... Just based on the interaction he had with Chaz, I don't think that he's open to criticism. That's fine.
And I'm shutting you down.
Yes.
Because it's so much fun, Jan. All right. Most importantly, our wonderful guest, Chaz Fisher, thank you for joining us. Once again, as you did in the last one, tell the people where they can find you and what they'll find you doing.
Oh, thank you so much. And again, genuine honor to be here for episode 200. Main thing that you can find me on is Draft Zero, a screenwriting podcast. Only listen if you are interested in writing. Otherwise, it is like 3-hour slog analyses of screenplays. And, you know, I've had my laugh criticized and called super obnoxious by reviews. So something about podcasting that really brings out the best in listeners. But no, that like I am proud of the work we do there. It's just not a casual drop-in listening experience. But, you know, we did well enough to attract Quentin Tarantino as a listener. So
there you go. I think that people that listen to podcasts about movies, such as this one, there's a good chance that a solid percentage of them are interested in how movies are made and screenwriting is part of it. And I mean, I don't know, obviously I'm into writing, so I get to enjoy your show that way. I think that maybe even if I did not write, I would be kind of like fascinated by the nuts and bolts approach of putting a screenplay together. And you and Stu are a lot of fun to listen to. So that always helps, you know? So I'm just trying to counter, like balance out a little bit like how self-deprecating you are when you're talking about your show. You're making it sound like it's completely inaccessible. And I don't think that's the case.
We've been running for 10 years. We've got over 100 episodes. Many of those episodes are over 2 hours long and people seem to want us to make more. So, you know, we must be doing something right. But the original pitch is we do your homework so that you don't have to. Like there was that kind of truism. If you wanted to be a screenwriter, you should read screenplays, watch movies and write. And we're like, we're going to do that for you. Other than the writing bit. We'll do 2 out of 3 for you.
Chaz, next time you are here, we'll do a movie that's rotten. In between Contrarian's Corner and Real Talk, you were telling me you enjoyed the episodes where we talk about shitty movies or movies that are perceived as shitty. So that will be next.
I'm going to do a mild Patreon pitch for the future because I am a patron of this podcast and means I get to pick movies for the feeds. So you guys in your near future have a double bill coming up of Demolition Man and Sylvester Stallone's Judge Dredd.
God bless.
I love it. All right. That's enough. Enough bloodletting, as you say, Alex. Let's get out of here.
Welcome to our end credits.
Or as we usually call them, our perennial plugs.
We start off by giving thanks to the Festive Years who provide our opening and closing tracks. They kick us off with Last Stand and take us home with Summer of 99. Be sure to head over to thefestiveyears.com for any and all Festive Years needs.
Our friend and fellow podcaster Hans Rothgeiser is the man behind our logo and all the art you see related to our show. reach out to him and let him know how much you like that little tomato. His email address is mildemonios@hotmail.com and his website is mildemonios.pe. That's mildemonios. You can also check out his podcast Nación Combi about Peruvian current affairs and Marginal about economy. Hans, thank you for all your support.
For those interested in the regularly absurd world of professional wrestling, Joe and the boys over at latenightgrin.com have you covered. Tell them the Contrarian sent you.
And we'd like to close with special thanks to our social media team of Zoe Perez and Corey Ari. Each of the social media accounts we mentioned in the introduction look as good as they do because of their work.
So that'll do it for this episode of The Contrarians, where we're right and you're wrong, and we will catch you next time. How much money he makes a year, or who he knows. Just promise me.